Anybody want to check and see if there appears to be a large comet headed for Earth at the moment? These have been strange times. Hey, Graham, God, good to hear your voice again.
Nice to hear yours too, Art. It's been a while.
Now that I've heard it, you're going to have to stay a little away from the phone there.
Okay, Graham. I'll try to keep it away. I think I put new rechargeable batteries in my old telephone, and it's now too loud.
I see. Is that a portable phone?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Do you have one that you can pick up?
I don't. They're all hands-free, I'm afraid.
I see. All right. Well, anyway, it's good to hear you again. And, you know, I started out, Graham, by saying that the last couple of years, and it's been a while since you and I have spoken.
It is. Yeah.
They've been very bad times for archaeologists worldwide. I mean, things are beginning to be seen and researched all over the place that would seem to indicate that mankind has been here a lot longer than they've been telling us.
Well, certainly civilized mankind.
Yes.
There have been new discoveries, new finds, changes. There's a lot that's being shaken up at the moment, and I think we're going to see some very interesting times ahead.
Why, Graham, did we not find you at the telephone number we had listed for you?
Okay, here's the thing. I have two places. I live most of my time in the West Country of England, in Devon. Very far from any town. But sometimes I have to be in London, so we have a small place here, and when I have to work in London, we come up and stay here.
I see.
And I had given the London numbers, but I think what happened was that you'd been trying my numbers in Devon.
I see.
That's it, really.
I see. Okay. Easy enough. Anyway.
Easy enough, yeah. Yeah, well, luckily I had your hotline, so I called in.
Now, as you've seen all of this stuff unfolding, you know, all of these new discoveries, I suppose you've heard about off the coast of Cuba and all the rest of that?
Absolutely, yes. The Cabo San Antonio, very interesting, yes.
You must feel somewhat vindicated.
I think it's too early to go around feeling vindicated, but what I feel is that the basic proposition that I put forward, which is that there was a higher level of civilization, perhaps much higher than we've expected way back in the Ice Age, and that an urban city-dwelling culture, a culture that had reached that level, was destroyed by the rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age, and that we're going to find the remains of it underwater. That seems to be being supported by evidence at the moment, but we need to do a whole lot more work on these places, and there's a lot of bridges to cross yet, but it's looking good.
All right, well, we're all hearing about Cuba, and we're waiting for information on that. What can you tell us about what's been found off the coast of India?
Well, what's been found off the coast of India, you have two separate sites. You have sites in the northwest of India, and you have sites as about as far away from those as you can get and still be in India, in the southeast of India. And I've been following both of these areas as a diver and as a researcher for several years now. What happened in May of 2001 was that one of India's government agencies, the National Institute of Ocean Technology, which specializes in high-tech instrumentation for remote surveys on the seabed, was conducting a survey in a place called the Gulf of Cambay in northwest India. Now, they were not doing archaeology. They were there actually testing the pollution levels in the Gulf of Cambay.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using an instrument called side-scan sonar, which sends out a beam down to the seabed and which bounces back an image of what's on the seabed.
Gee whiz, just like in Cuba.
Just like in Cuba, South Carolina. However, it's gone a lot further than that. So back in May last year, they were doing this survey, and they started to notice very regular geometrical formations on the seabed. They had geologists with them, and they just couldn't understand what these things were. They were about 120 feet down, and they were very extensive. And they focused their survey in that area, followed this up, and they found that what they seemed to be sitting on top of were two cities, roughly 5 miles long and about a mile wide, laid out alongside of ancient riverbeds, parallel to each other but about 15 miles apart. And to give a sense of the size of these cities, if you added them both together, you would have a city the size of Manhattan.
My God.
Now, this is very extraordinary, and it was a very extraordinary discovery at the time, because the depth of submergence suggests that these are very old. But when the National Institute of Ocean Technology went public with its findings in May last year, nobody took them seriously, because the suggestion that there could have been fantastic cities of this scale thousands and thousands of years ago, which have been covered up by water, was just too difficult for archaeologists to swallow. And they suffered a lot of ridicule at that time. But they didn't give up, and they went back with their research vessel, and they pulled up using, in fact, a mechanical grab. They pulled up, they put themselves over the top of the cities, and they pulled up from the seabed more than 2,000 man-made artifacts, including pottery, jewelry, even human remains, teeth, bones, a vertebrae, a jawbone, wonderful things.
Wow, how would human remains last that long? I can understand some other artifacts, but human remains, that's amazing.
In fossilized form, yeah, they do. And these were fossilized. And they had lasted, because they ran carbon dating tests on pieces of cut wood that were found amongst this artifact. The wood was perfectly preserved.
Right.
And the date that they got from the carbon dating, which is a standard archaeological tool, and I'm often accused of ignoring it, but a date that was given by carbon dating was 9,500 years ago, 7,500 B.C. That's about 4,000 years older than any city known to archaeologists anywhere in the world. And it suddenly led to a huge jump in the seriousness with which these ruins on the bottom of the Gulf of Cambay were taken, because no longer could it be said that they were simply an artifact of the imaging process or some kind of scientific hallucination. Mm. Once you pull 2,000 artifacts out of them, it obviously and logically enormously increases the possibility that they're man-made. And in fact, nobody in India is in serious doubt about that now.
Well,
so we're dealing with something that confounds the established picture of history, because we're supposed to have started developing cities 5,000 or less than 5,000 years ago, with the gradual growth and emergence of civilization, which has always been thought to have started in the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East near Iraq.
Yes. Oh yes.
And now suddenly thousands of years earlier, we have these cities which simply can't be explained.
Our educational institutions around the world have not yet begun to respond to this. In other words, what they're teaching in school with regard to archaeology and our past remains virtually unchanged, Graham.
I would expect that to be so for quite a while. It's going to take the archaeological community about 5 years, I would guess, to digest this new information. First off, they have to get rid of all their objections to it and satisfy themselves that it is a genuine discovery, which I have no doubt that they'll do, and then come to terms with what it means. If it is what it seems to be, I think any archaeologist would agree that it turns over the established story of the origins of civilization.
Well, in what way? In what way do you think they will now explain what they know about man's presence on the planet in such manner? What are they going
to say? You have to understand that the first, for archaeologists who are invested in the present view of the past, which is a straight line development from rather simple and primitive beginnings through a nice series of gradual evolutionary steps until we get cities and eventually end up with what we have today, that such an idea simply cannot accommodate cities that are 9,000 years old at the bottom of the Gulf of Cambay. And in fact, I have to stress that the date on those cities, which is retrieved from carbon-dated artifacts, is supported by sea level studies, because there's a whole science which studies the extent to which sea level rose at the end of the last ice age.
Mm-hmm.
And this science puts the submergence of the Gulf of Cambay round about 7,700 years ago. So it means that the cities there couldn't have been built before that date, and so the carbon date of about 1,500 years older than that makes sense.
All right. Well, maybe you can describe...
To answer your question, very difficult for archaeologists to accommodate themselves to this. So the first And the first thing we're going to see is several years of intense critical focus on these signs to see if they can be dismissed. That'll be the first thing that happens.
Mm-hmm. But if everybody, if it's confirmed, and we're now 5 or 10 years later,
yeah.
What conclusions do we draw about ourselves, and what changes in thinking, in what kind of circles will this create?
Well, for me, first and foremost, what it means is that the vast heritage of mythology that we have from all around the world, which testifies to global floods, and which has been scorned and ignored by archaeologists as irrelevant to archaeological research, this is going to have to change.
Yes.
Because we're looking at a phenomenon. The work that I've been doing for the last 5 years has been following up every possible lead in this area of underwater structures, and I'm a diver, and I've been diving on structures all around the world. And there is evidence for massively ancient underwater structures in almost all parts of the world. So this looks like the global traces of a cataclysmic event or a series of cataclysmic events.
And well, there's still Okinawa that they're trying to figure out, and now, of course, Cuba. And I know that you've seen the reports on Cuba. And in the case of Cuba, Graham, it's 2,200 feet.
Yes, Cuba is fascinating. It's a very deep site. Now, we have to realize with a site that's submerged to a depth of 2,200 feet, that we are not dealing solely with the issue of sea level rise at the end of the ice age.
Obviously not.
Because that would account at the most for 400 feet of submergence.
I've heard some people say as much as 900, but certainly no more, nowhere near 2,200.
Nowhere near 2,200 and nowhere near 900 too, except that you do get variations around the world simply because of land subsidence and land elevation, which occurs in all of these places at the same time that the sea is going up and down. Generally speaking, you wouldn't find a greater depth of submergence than about 400 feet, which is a very great depth. As a result of sea level rise. So if these cities are submerged to 2,200 feet, the most logical conclusion to draw is that they must have been carried down to that depth in some kind of underwater landslide. This is possible. Apparently, it's particularly possible in that area. But, of course, I'm jumping ahead of the finds and assuming that these are man-made structures. Mm-hmm. They may not be. They may not be man-made. I have a feeling, I hope, they are.
Well, all right. Let's go back to India then for a second with the artifacts that have been brought up. If we go out on a limb and speculate about what it was like for the people on that land that's now so far below water, what do we imagine it was like?
Well, the clearest signature of what kind of people they were comes from the character of the buildings that they've left behind, which are now on the seabed. And these are very extensive structures with huge walls and massive foundations. There's another technique called sub-bottom profiling, which will do, it kind of takes an X-ray of the sea bottom and looks at what's underneath the bottom. And what sub-bottom profiling has shown on these structures in the Gulf of Cambay is that they have massive foundations, very, very strong, and probably made of very large blocks of stone. The character of the walls that are left above water is just huge. It's on an enormous scale and very geometrical, with lots of right angles in it, and you can see clear shapes of large square and rectangular constructions. Now, for a society to put all of this together, 9,000 or more years ago, you have to understand that at that period of the past, what archaeology says we're dealing with is just small villages and settlements.
Yes.
The very largest that you might find, well-known places like Jericho and Kapıhayak in Turkey, which are both known early settlements, are about 150 times smaller than what we find on the bottom of the Gulf of Cambay. So it's completely out of context and perspective in the period to which it's applied. Now, even beyond that, you have to when you look at a big city, you have to ask yourself, how did those people support themselves? How did they eat? How did they sustain themselves?
Exactly.
And it's difficult to imagine a city or cities of these sizes being established without a solid agricultural base to feed them. However, 9,000 years ago, agriculture is supposed to have been only just beginning, not have got to the stage where it could support large cities. Far from that, thousands of years away from that. So there we have another mystery. And I think it's possible that the answers to all of these mysteries are on the 10 million square miles of land that was submerged by rising sea levels around the world at the end of the Ice Age. That's an area bigger than South America and North America as far as the Canadian border added together.
Well, there are many people like myself who wonder about the following, Graham. We may not have time for a good answer here, but if there are really all these undersea cities about the world, then the U.S. government with its submarines, the Russian government with its submarines, should know about these things, shouldn't they?
Well, a place where they particularly should know about them is the Persian Gulf, because that area must be amongst the most heavily
patrolled
waters in the world.
Absolutely.
And the entire Persian Gulf was dry with a beautiful river running through it until about 12,000 years ago.
Right. So are you guessing they do know and have not said anything?
I expect I am. Although, frankly, the places where submarines go is not necessarily the same places that you'd expect to find submerged ruins.
Perhaps not, but
often in much deeper water. But I'd be very surprised if some anomalies have not been found. And indeed, we have reports from the Russians going back to the 1980s of quite a few very strange things being found in the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, really? Okay, let's hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. Graham Hancock is my guest from Great Britain. I'm Art Belvis. Now back to Graham Hancock in Great Britain. Graham, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, oh, that sounds...
Hopefully on a quieter telephone.
Oh, it sounds so much better, yes. Uh-huh.
Oh, good.
All right, so you have been...
The only problem for me now is I can't pace, you see. I like to pace when I'm talking. Now I'm fixed to the chair with a fixed line. But anyway, let's go.
Do you really like to pace back and forth?
Yeah, I do. I'm a pacer. I don't know why, but I just can't take a telephone call sitting still. However, I'm doing so now,
yeah,
so it's a good experience for me.
All right, you've been doing an Indiana Jones thing all over the world, it seems like, something in the Bay of Bengal. What are you doing there?
This is southeast India. We were talking a few moments ago about big cities that have been discovered underwater in northwest India.
That's right, yeah.
But right far away in the southeast of India, often a state of India called Tamil Nadu, inhabited by Tamil-speaking people, there has been another discovery. And in fact, this discovery was made by Indian archaeologists some years ago, back in 1993. They were doing a survey of ruins which were very close to shore in that area. In fact, they were so close to shore that some of them were exposed, completely exposed at low tide. And these ruins were dated accurately to not very old, between 300 BC and 300 AD.
Mm-hmm.
But while they were doing that survey, they also decided to look in deeper water. And they went out, again, using initially side-scan sonar, but in this case supported by diving and as well, including by myself. They went out with side-scan sonar, and they found at 5 kilometers from the shore, say 3 miles out from shore,
right,
at a depth of 70 feet, a very large structure which shouldn't be there. They couldn't figure out what it was. It was shaped like a horseshoe, and it was shown on the side-scan sonar to be surrounded by other structures. In 93, they put down some marine archaeologists to dive on it, and they found that it was a man-made structure with courses of blocks clearly visible in the side of it under the marine growth. But they didn't know what to do with it because it was so far from shore. It didn't appear, couldn't be connected to the ruins that were inshore and much younger.
Now, actually put on gear and went out there yourself?
Yeah, I've been diving for 5 years, and specifically in order to follow up wonderful anomalies like this. I found out about this structure in a very obscure journal published by India's National Institute of Oceanography, just like a footnote to their study on the inshore structures. And I decided this is extremely intriguing, and I have to have a look at it. It took me about a year and a half to get permission from the Indian government to dive there. But finally, last year, I went back, in fact, with a film crew, and we dived on this structure and filmed it, and it is the most fantastic, enormous structure, which archaeologists admit would have required a high technology, quote-unquote, to build.
Graham, why is it hard to get a permit to dive there?
Believe it or not, although India has fabulous coasts and a very long coastline, there is almost no leisure diving in India. There's only a couple of places in India where a scuba diver can dive.
Yeah, I understand. At that, these were shark-infested waters.
Well, it's not only that. It's just that the scuba diving as a culture has never really developed in India. There is commercial diving, but there's no... I mean, people who are diving to free anchors and bring up salvage and so on. But there's no leisure diving. So immediately, anybody diving in India has huge problems of supply, getting compressors, getting tanks, all of this kind of thing.
Yes.
You just can't do it. And as soon as you start to do it, it's referred back to the government, and they say, well, why do you want to dive? And they quite strictly control their waters. So it took a very long time to just get permission to dive there. And then because there are no logistics and no facilities, it was necessary for India's National Institute of Oceanography to go there also to bring in a portable compressor so that we could have air in our tanks.
I wonder what they're afraid of, though. I mean,
I don't think they're afraid of anything. I just think that in other places, for example, the Caribbean, where everybody dives all the time,
yes.
The idea of a diver has become normalized, and people are quite used to seeing folk dressed up in masks and fins and so on. But in India...
Huh.
The idea of a diver is not normalized, and the immediate suspicion is, why is this person diving? Is he going to try to steal something from us? Is it some kind of security issue? This was particularly large in the Gulf of Cambay in the northwest, which is near the troubled areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
So I guess in every country there's a Zahi waiting somewhere, huh?
Well, yes. In the case of India, it's just rather charming and... Yeah, Zahi Hawass,
yes.
From Egypt.
Yes.
It's just rather charming and slow-moving. It's a sort of worst of British bureaucracy, tinged with sort of 50 years of the worst of Indian bureaucracy as well, and everything just takes a long time to happen. But in a very nice, polite way, and as long as you're patient, and there's no reason not to be patient with India because it's one of the oldest countries in the world, as long as you're patient, you will eventually get to do what you want to do, and that I did. Dived on this structure. Filmed it, and we are returning there in a month's time with a full-scale expedition, again jointly with the National Institute of Oceanography, but with a lot of technical divers from Britain, in order to survey the other 27 structures that have been found nearby.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, what's intriguing about this structure in Southeast India is the depth of submergence on that coast. We have to... Remember that I mentioned this earlier, but there is an increasingly highly developed science which takes into account all the variables that you need to take into account to figure out what the sea level was on any particular location, anywhere in the world, at any particular time. And when that program is run on this site, we find that the underwater structure that I've dived on there was submerged 11,500 years ago.
11,500 years.
That, by the way, is the same date that's given in Plato for the submergence of Atlantis in another ocean.
Well, one of the major things, I think, that will come crashing home to people as they realize these areas that were above ground 11,000 or 11,000 and a half years ago or whatever... even millions of years ago at 2,200 feet or whatever. I mean, if it happened once, Graham, it could happen again.
I think that's one of the most humbling lessons of this new material, which is now coming out all around the world, is that it is really possible that our ancestors reached a much higher level of development than we imagine.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps they formed a different kind of civilization to the one we've created, but if they lived in cities, they were certainly a highly developed people. But this could have happened and then been forgotten.
Is it possible that along with an older civilization that went much, much farther than we imagine, there would have been a technology of some description that we don't fully understand today, perhaps a technology that was able to do things that we almost can't do today, like build pyramids, I don't know, whatever, they developed some sort of probably what we would call magic today.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure it's natural to do all of this.
It's a harnessing of natural forces. Well, of course, we're entering a highly speculative area here.
Yes,
so speculation is fun.
Yes.
So let's speculate. Once we cross the barrier and accept that it appears that there was a whole earlier layer of civilization, mm-hmm. which we're only just beginning to find out about,
right.
And that had reached the level of an urban civilization,
right.
then it would be very surprising if there wasn't some kind of technology involved. To get an organized, complex culture that can build cities involves so many processes that it would be almost a miracle if there wasn't a technology involved. But at the same time, you know, the evidence for this remains to be confirmed and remains to be established as to whether that's so or not. I like to think, from studying ancient texts, and in this case particularly relevant are the ancient texts of India, that we may be looking at a society which in some ways was very different from ours. If they developed technology, it would have been of a different sort. The primary interest of that society was not particularly technological or material.
Mm-hmm.
You can even see this in India today, that millions of people in India spend their entire lives just wandering as pilgrims from place to place, having completely renounced the world because they believe that attachment to the world slows down the progress of the soul. So we can't assume that an earlier society, an earlier civilization, was as interested in technology as we are.
And perhaps not at all in the sense that we are. It may have been it could have been a civilization that was based on certain beliefs,
yes.
based on certain facts that we
yes.
no longer understand, correct?
I think that's exactly the way to look at it, that it raises two questions. Not only the possibility that great civilizations can be destroyed and lost for thousands of years, almost without trace, but also that the pattern in which a civilization evolves is not necessarily fixed in the model that we have today. Perhaps there are other ways for this to happen. Perhaps our kind of global dominant society today is only one of many routes that human beings could take, and then perhaps not even necessarily the best.
Well, sure, isn't it rather egotistical to imagine this is the only way? With regard to the first site you were talking about, Mike in Anaheim, California asks, you know, I hear the currents are too strong for diving on the site. How might people eventually explore the site and do so in a way which does not involve dredging for artifacts?
Right. Good question, and a good point raised in it, because dredging for artifacts is, it was necessary in this case because it was necessary to establish once and for all that these were man-made sites.
Yeah, but then you got to take the next step, right?
You've got to take the next step, and dredging won't do it. Now, when I first got on to this story, which is close to a year ago now, that was when I put in my applications to dive with the National Institute of Ocean Technology, who found these structures in the Gulf of Cambay. When we went back there to film with them, which we did in just a month or two ago in December, we still did not have permission to dive in the Gulf of Cambay, and they themselves had not dived in the Gulf of Cambay. And the reason for this is these enormous currents. There's actually a 30-foot difference between high tide and low tide in the Gulf of Cambay.
Wow.
And the site is more than 20 miles from shore. Now, the most dangerous thing for any diver, forget about sharks, forget about anything like that, the most dangerous thing is to get carried away by a current.
Mm-hmm.
If you are carried off by a current and you surface half a mile from your boat, unless they have a fast recovery vessel, a launch, which can go out and pick you up, and it often can't see you if there's waves even 3 feet high.
Then you're dead.
You're dead, and there's no shore to swim to. So this is a deep site. It's 120 feet deep in places. It involves a lot of logistics and backup for diving, and for just securing that people don't die there.
It's actually almost like drifting away from a spacecraft without a tether, isn't it?
It is. It is like drifting away from a spacecraft without a tether, and I've done it several times. And the two occasions when I've come closest to losing my life as a diver have both been because of that, of surfacing and literally not seeing the boat that you jumped off. It's gone.
God, that's got to be scary.
Know? It is a very scary thing, and it's a scary thing when you're less than a mile from shore and have some chance to swim to shore, but it's an impossibly scary thing when you're 20 miles from shore, as is the case in the Gulf of Cambay. So very careful steps have to be taken to ensure that diving is safe there, but it can be done, and we're hoping to dive on that site with a bit of luck within the next 6 months.
Well, you'd be certainly to be commended for not only talking and researching, as so many academics do, but going out there and looking for yourself. Now, you saw this with your own eyes. Is there any question at all about what you saw?
No. As far as I'm concerned, I've seen a lot more evidence on this than has so far been made public. And by the way, this story, the story of the Indian underwater cities, is hardly known about at all in the U.S. I think you must be one of the first shows to be talking about it.
Believe me, you're absolutely correct. Now, we were aware of it. We'd had the headlines fairly recently, but no details, Graham.
Yeah, that's right. The story just hasn't been picked up in the U.S. for some reason, but it will be. It'll gradually start dawning on the people.
Well, same deal with one in Cuba. The story is there if you have the right people doing the research, but it's not hitting. Well, it did briefly hit CNN, just briefly, but it's just not being embraced yet.
Yeah, that's right, and it's very difficult to embrace. See, what happens is if somebody wanting to run a news item on this on the TV rings up some academic expert and says, well, what do you think of this story? He's going to say, oh, it's rubbish, forget about it.
I know.
And therefore it gets forgotten about. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy until it actually creeps up behind you and bangs you on the head, you know, which is what it's about to do.
Well, I asked somebody the other night, I do so many good interviews, what it would take for scientists, for archaeologists to suddenly accept all of this. And he sat back and thought for a moment, and he said, well, they've got to all die off.
This is also true, unfortunately.
Do you think it's that bad?
And it's often the case with new ideas that they seem outrageous at the time. Later, when a whole generation has passed away and a new generation has become the establishment, those ideas get accepted. It can happen again. But I must say, to be fair to archaeologists, I do believe that confronted by evidence which they could not refute, they would accept that they have to change their picture of the past.
Well,
I think it'll be painful,
but
I think it will come. They're just going to require more evidence than they've got at the moment.
Well, from what I've heard, and maybe I'm wrong, but what I've heard is that many archaeologists, when confronted with some evidence, some artifacts that they simply cannot explain, end up, instead of doing what science should do and proceeding to find out, sort of just take it and put it up on the shelf and say, look, it doesn't fit, it's some kind of weird anomaly, let's just not think about it and put it up there.
Yeah, they ignore it. This is, unfortunately, the first reaction, and it's why new ideas and new discoveries have a very high threshold to cross before they get recognized. And in a way, I think this is a very unfortunate side of quote-unquote science as it concerns our ancient history, that instead of a welcoming openness to new ideas and new evidence, there's hostility and suspicion towards them. And that mindset automatically makes it very difficult to discuss and present new ideas. I personally think that a more tolerant, more encouraging climate from the scientific community, even if it led them on some wild goose chases, would probably produce better results for humanity in the end.
Mm-hmm. But it may not be our generation that truly comes to grips with this, and certainly it may not be our colleges and universities that teach this newly discovered material until a generation passes.
Likely to be the case. Likely to be a generation.
They'll have to keep listening to this program and others like it, I guess, if they want to know what's really going on. That's sad. I understand you've also done something off the coast of Malta.
Yeah. A one area amongst several. I've got a new book coming out. This is not a plug because it won't be published in the U.S.
Oh, you can have a plug. Go right ahead.
It won't be published in the U.S. for another 6 months, but it's being published here in Britain. In fact, it's published today, and it's called Underworld. And what it is a worldwide examination of this phenomenon of mysterious underwater ruins, supported by my own direct diving all around the world, but also setting it in context of what we know about the world in this period and what we don't know.
Hold it right there for a sec. Ask you about this. I've been reading a nightly story about global warming.
Yes.
I've been reading about penguins that are retreating in the Antarctic because it's too damn warm where they are.
Yeah.
Tonight, here in the U.S., Graham, they're running a story about a ice chunk two times the size of Manhattan that just broke off from Antarctica. And when you begin to hear these stories and you see our scientists and climatologists talking now about rapid climate change, boy, are they running a lot of stories about rapid climate change.
Yeah, we clearly are in a period of very rapid climate change at the moment.
Yeah. Well, if all of this ice were to melt, that would be very bad news. And
if all of the ice in Antarctica were to melt, you would look at you'd look at every coastal city in the world being submerged.
Yes, indeed. And so, is it possible in your mind that thousands and thousands of years could pass after an event like this, should it occur, and some future civilization would be digging down or diving down and finding these remarkable cities that once existed. York, San Francisco.
I think that if you take our culture today, what's distinctive about it is its global spread. We are all over the world.
Yes.
I mean, the signature of modern industrial society is not quite everywhere. It's not yet in the Brazilian rainforest, fortunately, although it is in some ways. But you know, it's very, very widely distributed. And therefore it would take more than global floods flooding millions of square miles of coastline to completely eliminate all traces of us. It would take something of the order of an asteroid or a comet strike, I think, to do that. An earlier civilization that had confined itself to coastlines, that had chosen to live on the coast, which is a very sensible thing to do during an ice age when the inland areas are extremely cold and unpleasant and almost inhabitable, that such a civilization would be selectively wiped out by flooding.
Hmm. So while we see the signs of some major change, or we might be on the precipice of a major change, that's fair speculation, certainly.
I think it's very fair speculation that we're on the precipice of a major change. I think you know, we have to realize that we as human beings are one of the most powerful forces operating in the world today. So we're quite capable of wiping ourselves out. We don't really even need nature to do it for us.
Well, okay, so whether it's nature or by our hand, either way, we do seem to be on this precipice. And if we're in the midst of proving this has happened before, that would be a really good reason for people not to want to think about this, wouldn't it?
Or a really good reason to want to think about it.
Depending, yes.
Depends on the person. Once you start putting the rise and fall of human civilizations into a perspective and realize that it's possible for whole episodes of the human story to be lost, then perhaps you have a greater investment in making sure that doesn't happen in the future.
But what about what about Malta?
Okay. Malta is one of the areas that I focused on in Underworld, and I focused on it because although Malta is a tiny place today, it's
right.
a tiny island, in fact a group of three small islands in the Mediterranean,
right.
It has an unusually large significance in the ancient history of mankind, and that is because what are thought by archaeologists to be the first great temples in the world were built on Malta, and they're what's called megalithic temples made with huge stones, megaliths,
mm-hmm.
the kind of stones that you see in a place like Stonehenge, for example.
Right.
These were used to construct a group of enormous temples on the Maltese islands, and these temples are dated back to 3,700 BC. Hmm. So that takes us back 5,700 years ago from today. They are the most spectacular and amazing temples you can imagine. Hardly anybody even hears of Malta, but my God, you go there and you see those temples, you see megaliths 20 feet tall towering above you, you see stones that weigh up to 100 tons which have been brought into position at the very dawn of history and raised up into these enormous temples. And a mystery strikes you. Where did they learn to do this? What's the background to this?
Yes.
The oldest temple on Malta is in many ways the most advanced. It's an enormous temple called Gigantea. That's after local folklore that says it must have been the work of giants. And it's dated to 3,700 BC, and it is a consummate work of construction by master builders and master engineers. The problem on Malta is there's no evidence of the evolution of this type of architecture. In fact, according to official archaeology, there had only been human beings at all on Malta for just 1,500 years before that. And when you look through the archaeological record, although you find them making mud huts and things like that, you don't find them making these fantastic megalithic temples. So it seems like part of the story is missing. And I began to look into the possibility that it could be missing underwater, because when you do the science and look at the map of Malta back through the ages, you find that today, although it's separated by 50 miles of sea from Sicily, 12,000 years ago, it was joined to Sicily. It was part of Sicily. And Sicily, in turn, was joined to mainland Italy. So Malta was part of the mainland. And this has never been taken into account in considering the origins and development of the temples, and that's what I've tried to do.
Just like we think that Central America was once perhaps connected to Cuba.
Yeah.
So, you know, this may not be just one place. You're certainly investigating one area of the world.
I'm confident that it's a worldwide problem.
I mean, look at the coast of Japan, for example.
Yeah, that's another area where I've put an enormous focus in over the last 5 years. And there's been a great deal of controversy about whether the underwater structures there are man-made or whether they're some kind of freak natural formations. And one of the things I've concentrated on doing in my new book and in the TV series that goes with it is to really explore that argument. And I took an extremely skeptical geologist with me to Japan to dive on the structures there. And he had to admit that the most spectacular of all of these structures is one that he simply cannot explain by any known natural forces. So it's very important. You see, what happens whenever, it's something we touched on a bit earlier, but whenever you come up with a discovery which fundamentally challenges the accepted version of history, the first thing you must expect is several years of intense fire being trained upon you to test that discovery. And in a way, this is a good thing. It's a good thing that the scientific method requires high standards of proof. And that's what I set out to try to find. But it's also a bad thing because it discourages inquiry into unusual and extraordinary possibilities which deserve to be inquired into.
Well, whatever part of the world it seems to be, Graham, we seem to have local myths that support the whole Great Flood idea. And that's universal. I mean, in every one of these areas, there are myths. Now, we call them myths, but, you know, they probably have some origin of truth in them.
I'm certain that they have a great amount of truth in them, which has been overlooked. You see, when the flood myth first started to be investigated, first became realized that there were flood myths, this was back in the 19th century. And at the time, what was applied to those flood myths was the model of the biblical flood. Scholars were at that time not disbelieving of the Bible, and they believed in a biblical flood. So the first flood evidence from other parts of the world and flood myths from other parts of the world were taken as evidence of the global nature of the biblical flood.
Mm-hmm.
Then this, as time passed and scientific archaeology developed, this view began to be questioned, and it became unpopular amongst scientists to believe in such a thing as the global flood of Noah. described in the Bible. And the new view began to take over, the so-called rational scientific Western view began to take over, that these were just myths which had been made up by primitive people. Perhaps they experienced a small river flood, and in their benighted ignorance, they imagined that it had affected the whole world. This, believe it or not, is the scholarly position on flood myths. I've also heard reputable scholars say that flood myths are kind of psychological projections to do with the birth process, that the embryo is in the womb, it's floating in fluid, and so we somehow have a natural tendency to imagine flood myths. To me, this is just garbage and hogwash. Flood myths are indeed universal. There's more than 600 myths from around the world. What they all speak of is a global flood that had a catastrophic effect on mankind. And what almost all of them say is that part of that catastrophic effect was the removal of a former civilization which had angered the gods and brought the flood down upon itself. And I don't think, now that we have very good science on the series of cataclysms that hit the world at the end of the Ice Age, I don't think we can afford to ignore anymore the possibility that the flood myths may be speaking about the end of the Ice Age.
Well, I guess a lot of people would take the attitude that, you know what, I really might believe it, but hey, what can I do about it? If we're facing something fairly soon of that magnitude, even though we have a greater civilization, no doubt more will survive, it would so change the world. It would be such a gigantic event that the average person could have no effect on it whatsoever. And really, that is more or less true, right?
Well, it's certainly true that the average person can have no effect on it whatsoever. However, an eloquent and interested public that wants to know about blind spots and missing pages in our history,
mm-hmm.
sooner or later, the pressure from that public will be felt by scholars to investigate this problem more thoroughly than it has been investigated. And I have to emphasize that, as far as I'm concerned, there is a real blind spot here. There's a real blind spot in archaeology because of the vast area that was flooded at the end of the Ice Age. I mentioned it earlier, but it's 10 million square miles. That's three times the size of Canada. It's the size of Europe and China added together. It's the size of South America and the U.S. added together.
But their blind spot in this area could lead to mankind's being blindsided.
Definitely. Definitely. If we have an incomplete picture of our past, if we've built our picture, because of our picture of the past, either consciously or unconsciously, forms the platform on which we build our future. And if that picture of the past is wrong, fundamentally wrong in major areas, then surely it's going to affect the way we look at our future, too.
And I really believe that is why people are reluctant to embrace the concept, because of what could happen, not because of what happened, but because of what it might mean for us.
I agree with you. I think there's no doubt about that. There is a sense in which quote unquote alternative history is quite subversive, really, because it is although it's not attacking or questioning any modern institution, it's attacking and questioning all the foundations on which modern institutions are built.
Is it still your view, Graham, that somewhere, perhaps under the Sphinx, there lies a library of information that might be the key to opening up the knowledge of what once was?
Yeah, I've got no reason to have abandoned that view, which I came to and expressed quite a while ago in work with my good friend Robert Boval.
Mm-hmm.
For the last 4 years, I have not been working on Egypt. I spent so much time involved in Egypt in the early mid-1990s and through to the late 1990s that I decided deliberately to give myself a break from it.
Sure.
And not focus in on that hothouse all the time.
But I know, but there are supporting elements of what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Right?
It all ties together as far as I'm concerned. I still remain convinced that there is a legacy in ancient Egyptian civilization which goes back, way back, thousands and thousands of years back, to precisely the same period that we call the end of the Ice Age. And that was a period. It wasn't a single moment.
Exactly.
It was a period of 10,000 years, between 17,000 and 7,000 years ago. And that's when everything happened for humanity. It's in exactly that period when the ice age is ending, the sea levels are rising, there's tremendous volcanic activity all around the world as continental plates shift with the ice burden lifted off them. It's exactly in that period that archaeologists start seeing the first tentative steps towards agriculture, the first evidence of agriculture. And what I'm wondering is, could those first agricultural settlers, the first farmers who it seems already knew how to farm, could they be the survivors of an earlier civilization that was destroyed by the floods?
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. So that's what I meant when I said one sort of supports the other in a
way.
Yes,
very, very much so. And the dating supports. And, you know, I mean, to raise a name that everybody has heard, which is the name of Atlantis, you know, what is... these days, I don't know how it is in America, but in Britain, if you talk about Atlantis, you're automatically considered to be mad. You don't need to do anything else to qualify for the madhouse. Just say the word Atlantis, and they'll put you in it. However, that's a very irrational view of Atlantis. What's intriguing about the Plato story of Atlantis is that he actually puts a date on it, which very few myths do. He said that it happened 9,000 years before the story reached the Greeks. And that takes us back to 9,600 BC, which is 11,600 years ago.
Right.
And that's smack in the middle of one of the big episodes of sea level rise at the end of the Ice Age.
So
how did Plato know that date? I mean, if he's made it up, and if he's just picking a date at random out of his imagination, isn't it intriguing that the phenomenon he describes, which is a worldwide flood, a flood that affected both the Atlantic and the Mediterranean and which destroyed a great civilization, that such events were happening at that time?
That all of this just so happens to coincide, that the big red X goes right over that period of time again and again and again. This should begin to mean something to people.
Yeah. It certainly should begin to mean something because it's a crucial period for us, and it's one that we just don't know enough about.
Well, and so then I can see how your research from Egypt naturally made the evolution to where it is now. I mean, it makes absolute sense to me.
Yeah, it was a natural linear progression, and also partly an attempt to listen to my critics, of whom I have many, who were saying, where's the hard evidence? Where's the real evidence that we can touch, that we can see, that we can weigh, that we can measure, which says that there was a lost civilization? And that's why... some years ago now, I learned to dive, and why diving's become such an important part of my life, because the answer, if it's anywhere, has got to be underwater.
What is it like to see it for yourself?
Wonderful. Wonderful. I have had the most amazing experiences underwater in the last 4 years. To see, for example, an enormous megalithic stone circle, 100 feet underwater, still intact, off the coast of Japan. In beautiful water, which is so limpid and blue that you can see for 300-400 feet underwater. It's just incredible. And to drop down through this onto this, the most amazing structure, it's a huge stone circle. The central upright is 14 feet high. It's surrounded by uprights in a circle around it. There's a central pathway. It's the most amazing thing. To see something like that at that depth is surreal.
Well, I can only then ask you about your own personal experience. Is there any way in your mind, after seeing it, that you can say to yourself that this is not... or is there any way you can imagine in your mind this is all sort of a natural 100 monkeys
kind
of...
Well, no. That's why I took a very skeptical German geologist with me to dive on that stone circle that I've just been describing. Because I realized that there's just no point in me arguing that these things are traces of an earlier civilization if geologists can stand up and say, hey, they're just natural. They're not even man-made at all. So I needed to rule that out, and I'm glad to say that has been ruled out in the question of this massive stone circle at Karama.
All right. Hold it right there. When we come back, we'll try to get to the phones. Graham Hancock is my guest. The questioning, I'm sure, will go all over the place, as Graham has gone all over the place. Just before going to the phones, and that's what we're about to do, since we have found so much evidence for those with minds open enough, or in your case, people who are able to dive and see the evidence for themselves of something that occurred 11,500 years ago, whatever, this great flood, then is there any evidence at all of going back yet another period or another period? In other words, anything suggesting that this may be a cyclical thing that happens about every 11,500 years?
Hmm. I haven't concerned myself with areas further back than the end of the last ice age, because
right.
it seems to me the simplest and the most obvious solution to the problem of the myths and to the problem of very puzzling underwater structures. But I mean, one thing to bear in mind is I think most scientists are agreed that anatomically modern human beings, people who look just like you and me, who behave just like you and me, have been around for more than 100,000 years, possibly a lot more, but certainly for more than 120,000 years. And it does seem bizarre that we should only achieve, you know, one high civilization, one pattern of civilization during that time. I mean, starting from about 5,000 years ago or so, perhaps a bit before that. What were we doing with ourselves during the, you know, the other 95,000 years? That's the problem for me.
Possibly coming and going at intervals.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right, well, let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to ask you questions. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hi, it's Ethan.
Hi, where are you, Ethan?
I am in Idaho. This is Eileen.
Oh, Eileen, I'm sorry, all right.
Okay, I actually have a question basically in regards to the debunkers of your theory.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school during my American history class, my history teacher had put to us, why does every culture have a flood story? And then his response to that was because every culture has always been built on a waterfront, and you addressed that a little bit earlier. However, recently on PBS, I saw something that said that after or during one of the ice ages, I want to say it's the Bering Sea. I am probably wrong. There was
the Bering Strait between Alaska and Siberia.
Okay, that there was a break in the landmass that did cause a very serious flood that was imprinted into the into humanity's subconscious, and everybody built a story around it, a myth around it. The thing is, okay, that explains Europe. How does it explain the fact that even Native Americans have a flood story?
Mm-hmm. Because the flood or flooding was a universal phenomenon at the end of the Ice Age. I again come back to the basic figures which geologists accept, which is that all around the world, the amount of coastline, it's not just coastline. In the case of China, for example, 1,000 miles of coast was just wiped out. That when you add all these areas up, you come to an area which is 10 million square miles, which is as big as a continent, that has been swallowed up by the sea and never properly looked at by archaeologists. It's true that there is a thing called marine archaeology, but they're primarily interested in shipwrecks because they don't believe that there are anything of great interest to find underwater regarding human settlements.
Oh, by the way, somebody sent me an interesting note by computer when we were wondering earlier about the world's major technological militaries like ours and the Soviets and so forth. They said, well, look, you can imagine that if they had plotted or seen on sonar, or even visually, any of the things we're talking about right now, they would certainly not say so, because that would identify exactly where their subs had been. And
exactly.
They don't do those things in the military.
No. There would be no incentive for announcing this at all.
All right.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. First time caller line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hello.
Hi,
Graham.
Hi.
I wanted to ask if you could share an area where I could do some research on the biblical flood.
Yeah. I know a gentleman who visits my website quite regularly, who is an expert on the subject, and has very intriguing views about it. He's called Ward Sanford. And I suggest you check into my website, into the message board on my website, and have a look there. You'll see his name has come up if you run the search, and follow what he's been saying. I think you could find that very interesting.
That's Ward Sanford.
Ward Sanford, S-A-N-F-O-R-D. And in fact, I know that he's planning a book on specifically on the issue of the biblical flood in a year or so from now. And my website is www.grahamhancock.com.
And of course, we have a link on my site.
And you have a link on your
site.
If you go to the message board there and search the name Ward Sanford, you'll find some interesting posts which will lead you in other directions. There's also a book by Ryan and Pittman called Noah's Flood, which is attempting to trace Noah's Flood to the Black Sea.
Yeah?
Because the Black Sea was cataclysmically flooded at the end of the Ice Age as well. What happened was that, I have to express this in kilometers because I don't know it in miles, but the area of the Black Sea is 500,000 square kilometers. And that area was flooded very rapidly at the end of the Ice Age, quite late, around about 7,500 years ago. And these two scholars, and they both are major scholars, believe that that may have been the source of the flood of Noah story in the Bible. My only criticism of that is that that's 500,000 square kilometers, but in fact in square kilometers, 25 million square kilometers were flooded around the world. And I think, the place really to be looking for direct connections to the biblical flood may more likely be in the Persian Gulf, which was another area that was extensively flooded at the end of the Ice Age. It was a beautiful area, a wonderful valley during the Ice Age with a huge river flowing through it. It's almost like the Garden of Eden, the combined streams of the Tigris and the Euphrates. No water in the Gulf at all from the sea, and then with the rising sea levels it was flooded and it all went underwater.
It's so hard for the average person to even begin to grasp these concepts that everything could have been so different and so changed, and that the maps would all be different, and land masses would be...
Everything changes. The whole face of the Earth changes. One of the best ways to see this is graphically, and I do have a TV series with this, which will go out on the Learning Channel in the U.S. in a couple of months, where we show this graphically. When you take all the latest data on sea level rise and apply it to the globe, you see that the globe looked staggeringly different 12 or 14,000 years ago, and you suddenly realize that it's really possible that archaeologists just haven't been looking in the right place because they've been thinking with a modern mindset, not an Ice Age mindset.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Where are you, sir?
This is Kat from near San Francisco.
Okay.
Graham, I do sincerely believe that perhaps your landslide theory on the city outside of Cuba is perhaps the wrong geological approach.
Could be. It's not really a theory or even my theory. It was actually a theory that was mentioned to me by a geologist who was trying to explain what these ruins, if anything, could be of Cuba. So I don't claim to be a specialist on the Cuban ruins. I think they're just another intriguing discovery, and I'm confident we're going to see much more information about them during the coming year.
Well,
so tell me what you think.
Well, you know, now, Graham, I don't know whether you know or not, the latest news is that not only have they the side scan radar in which they said they saw buildings, pyramidal shapes,
yep,
roads, every sign of a metropolitan-type city, actually. But now they've been down with video cameras.
Yeah.
And they've come back with additional evidence, and National Geographic is apparently involved in some way or another. But
well, that's great. I mean, that's what we want to see. We want to see the video from the site. Unfortunately, no diver is ever going to be able to go down to that depth, but we can go down in submersibles, and that's what's needed next. And I'm hoping that the reason that there's been a silence on this, a relative silence since the first announcements were made, is that the discoverers are putting together a proper expedition to do this job properly so that lots of nitpicking stupidity cannot be directed against them afterwards.
Well,
and if they're involved with National Geographic, that's great.
That is precisely what is occurring right now, Graham. They're keeping it very tightly held. I've had Linda Moulton Howe done several interviews with Paulina Zelitsky.
Yep, we talked to her too, yeah.
So there you are, and she's given us the lowdown. But, yeah, they're keeping quiet generally in the media about all of this for exactly...
They're wise to do so until they can deliver really persuasive proof, because as I said earlier, the automatic reaction of the establishment to news like this is to try to crush it at the outset before it has a chance to grow, and that's when it's most vulnerable. So they're right to keep their cards close to their chest until they're in a position to go public.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Where are you?
I'm down around Corpus Christi.
Okay.
I want to thank you for a great program, Art, and you keep these truck drivers awake out here early in the morning.
You're very welcome.
Graham, you're talking about the great flood and everything and how it covered up the coastal areas, and they're talking about the quickening and the climate. And the Arctic melt, and that it's going to cover up more coastline. Does that mean in another 10,000 years or eventually the whole Earth's going to be covered with water?
No. I don't think that there just isn't enough water on the Earth to do that. That cannot happen. But we could look at a 40 or 50-foot rise in sea level. That's not out of the question at all if Antarctica melts down. A 40 or 50 feet rise in sea level would be a catastrophic disaster for our civilization.
It would be interesting to project a 50-foot raise in sea level and simply show a new map. I mean, that could be done right now, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, it would wipe out every coastal city in the world for a start. And most of the great cities, New York, San Francisco, Tokyo, London, are pretty much coastal cities.
All gone.
All gone.
And you would have an utterly new map. It does not seem to me that it would be that difficult for somebody to produce such a map.
It could definitely be done. The geologists that I've been working with, obviously with a team in Britain, because that's where I'm based, they're at the University of Durham in the north of England. They have one of the best computer models of sea level rise in the past, but equally good models exist in geology departments in the U.S. And, you know, you can take that model, which looks at lowered sea level in the past and the gradual rise of sea level. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be possible to project it forward as well, and look at what a 50-foot rise in sea level would do. I hope one day these programs are going to be available to the public, because it just enables you to stand on any coastline in the world at any period in the last 20,000 years and see how it would have looked within all the best evidence.
Or how it may look.
Or how it may look. But it can be predictive as well, absolutely.
All right. West of the Rockies, you are on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Okay. Hi, Art.
Hello.
And Graham. Art, for you. We had a storm. I'm out in the darkness of Coos Bay. My name is Jack. I'm in the darkness of Coos Bay.
Oregon.
We had a storm come in here at 70-mile-an-hour winds. It knocked down the poles. I have a 7,600-volt line in the front of my yard. Mm. It wasn't that I had emergency power. Well, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now.
The whole world right now is experiencing.
Yeah, and the weatherman couldn't predict it. It came in.
Just
he did not believe it. It was awesome.
I understand. Yeah. So do you have a question for Graham?
Anyway, for Graham, we're about, 11,000 years past the what's considered the meltdown of the Ice Age, are we not?
Well, it carried on until about 7,000 years ago. But if you were looking for a central focus of it, that would be roughly between 14 and 11,000 years ago.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, the thing is, I sit at 65 feet above. I'm on an inlet bay is where I'm at. Anyway, I'm 65 feet above the bay. Anyway,
yeah.
But I was looking at this. They talk about if Antarctica melted off, we'd have a rise of 300 feet. Well, we've already risen, 150 feet, have we not?
Since the end of the Ice Age? More.
Yeah. More
now. The sea level rise since the end of the Ice Age has been 400 feet.
Oh, okay. So the thing is we don't have too much more to go, is what you'd be saying. Yes?
Well, I think the most threatening ice mass is the ice mass on Antarctica, and scientists have been aware how dangerous it is for quite a while. I believe it's the East Antarctic ice sheet which could theoretically slip into the sea.
And the problem with that is that it would occur almost as an instantaneous thing.
Yeah, if it came as a slide of a massive quantity of ice at once, this would have very catastrophic effects. I mean, if an ice sheet the size of Canada falls into the sea, you can imagine what sort of splash it's going to make.
And tidal waves. And
the displacement of huge amounts of water. I mean, that on its own would be a worldwide cataclysm of horrific extent.
Indeed. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hi, this is Mike from Amargosa calling.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to say something about earthquakes in two of the areas that Graham described
mm-hmm.
In India.
Yep.
In October, there was a 0.6 earthquake in the ocean 50 kilometers from Pondicherry.
Yep, that's in the east, on the east coast of India, yeah.
Yeah, southeast.
Yeah.
And I happened to be around 150 kilometers from there at the time, so I can tell you for sure there was an earthquake.
Yep.
And the Indian newspaper said that because of this Pondicherry quake, the scientists would have to redraw the earthquake zone map of India because previously they had not considered this to be an a high-risk area.
Yeah, that's very interesting. An earthquake. Now, you say this was 200 kilometers offshore?
Oh, no, the 50 kilometers in the from Pondicherry towards the ocean. In other words, in the ocean, 50 kilometers from Pondicherry.
I get you. Yeah. Yeah, it is unusual. Earthquakes in that area are unusual. It's a stable part of the continent. Up in northern India, different matter, of course. In northwest India, very bad earthquakes as a result of mountain building processes there. But in southeast India, no, it's supposed to be stable, so that is interesting.
Yes, the one in the north, of course, was famous, being devastating, the one in Gujarat.
That's right. That was one of the worst earthquakes that has occurred for a very long time, and it had catastrophic effects in Gujarat, which can still be seen to this day because I was out there relatively recently. But that's an area where you expect earthquakes.
Yeah.
And
well,
where they're regular. But in southeast India, they're not.
Yeah, well, since with this new information, I guess they can be expected now there also, it would seem that two of these civilizations that are underwater may actually be in earthquake zones. So I thought that might be interesting.
It's a very interesting point and one worth developing because the scientists who are studying the end of the Ice Age have found a very curious link between periods of rapid meltdown of the ice and periods of increased earthquake and volcanic activity around the world.
All right.
I'm sorry, Graham.
I've got to take a break here. We're at
okay.
the bottom of the hour. So hold on. Caller, very briefly, you're in Armagosa?
Yeah.
To what station are you listening?
Well, right now, 95.1.
95.1. K-N-Y-E, sir.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, thank you and good morning.
Alrighty, bye.
All right. We'll, once again, from across the land and across the sea, here is Graham Hancock. Graham, welcome back.
Thank you.
Lots and lots of people waiting to speak with you, so here we go. First time caller line, your turn with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. How are you?
Just fine. Where are you?
I'm calling from Yakima, listening to 1280 KIT.
In Washington, all right?
In Washington. Hey, Graham, got a question for you. Are you familiar with the Pacific Northwest area?
I'm not extremely familiar with it. Of course, I've been to, you're talking Seattle and this kind of area. Yeah, I've been there, but not very familiar with it.
Not very familiar with it. Okay, well, my question was on the same topic of the last caller. In the past couple of years, we've had a lot of activity up here. With earthquakes and so on and so forth. My curious thought is, what are your predictions within the next couple of years? What do you foresee happening with the Seattle area?
You know, I'm not really in the prediction business.
Yeah,
particularly local predictions. I mean, I can look at sort of global trends and say what I think is going down, but I can't really give you a good answer to that question.
I respect that enormously. We have plenty of people who do make those predictions. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Graham.
Hi.
I'm calling from just outside of Kansas City. I'm listening to 1200 WOAI.
Yes, sir.
My question is, between 1986 and 1990, Archaeological Magazine published an article about some college students from UCLA being in the desert of either Arizona or Nevada, and they found a rock that wasn't indigenous to that area.
Uh-huh.
They took this rock back, they did every test imaginable to it, and they ended up finally cutting it in half and finding a spark plug inside. How do you feel this falls in with your theories?
Very interesting. I've heard about many such examples. There's an excellent book called Forbidden Archaeology by
yes.
Cremo and Thompson,
yes.
which brings in a lot of good data on these kind of out of place artifacts, as they're called. To be honest, I don't have a
I don't have a view on it. I find the world is such an amazing place, and that human beings are such amazing creatures, and that everything, it's just such a mystery to be alive, that frankly I'm open to any possibility. I was saying a bit earlier that modern humans have been known to exist. I mean, people like us have been known to exist for about 100 or 120,000 years. But that doesn't mean that that our species has not existed longer. I think that one of the great mysteries still to be solved is the origin of humanity. So I don't think we can rule out completely vastly older levels and layers of civilization. It's just something that I'm not, one only has so much time, and my time I focus on the most recent and most likely episode, which is the end of the Ice Age, and that's just 17,000 down to 7,000 years ago.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Where are you, please?
Oh, hello, gentlemen.
Yes, hi.
Hi. This is Chris from Chicago. The late Jacques-Yves Cousteau, when he was investigating the Bimini Wall, claimed that he had a lot of problems with magnetic compasses, and that they gave out and quit. And I was wondering if you had any such trouble in your investigations.
Well, I've dived at Bimini quite extensively. I've made two quite major expeditions there. I did not notice magnetic anomalies, although I've heard of these. But I do think that, the Bimini Road, as it's called, was written off by scholars back in the 1970s. A bunch of geologists went over, they looked at it, they concluded that it's a natural formation made up of a thing called beach rock, which indeed does break up into blocky, regular formations. But I think that the work was done on this in the 70s was way too limited to come to such a conclusion, and there's a great deal of contradiction in the evidence. And what none of the evidence takes into account at Bimini is that Bimini stood on the northwest end of an enormous island during the Ice Age. The whole of the Grand Bahama Bank was exposed 400 feet above sea level, and would have been a much more attractive place to live than the continental United States at that time, which was frozen stiff. So I think when we assess the Bimini Road, we have to assess the Ice Age history of the area as well, and that so far hasn't been done. I've tried to do it in my new project.
Mm-hmm. I also think that it's noteworthy that some of these findings off the coast of Cuba and Okinawa coincide with the lost cities of Atlantis and Mu, also the Bermuda Triangle and the Devil's Triangle.
Well, we've got a whole range of ideas and thoughts about mysterious parts of the world, some of which are better substantiated than others. But I think the one common factor which connects all of these places is that they were above water at the end of the Ice Age and are underwater now.
Mm-hmm. All right, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
Okay, my name is Ralph. I'm from Montana.
Yes, sir.
I've got a question regarding the great floods of Missoula. I'm sure you're...
Missoula flood, yes. The Lake Missoula, Glacial Lake Missoula.
Yeah, and I was wondering how that might relate to your the overall scheme of your discussion. If
it relates very closely to it. When you talk about rising sea levels, obviously, they have to rise because water is pouring into the sea. And the reason, what happened when the ice caps at the end of the Ice Age melted, first off, let's take a step back. When we talk about these ice caps that covered North America and Northern Europe, these things were 2 miles thick, and they covered millions of square miles. Now, you're looking at just an enormous amount of ice. All that ice was formed by water that had come out of the sea. So when the ice melted, it all had to go back into the sea. And what happened was, this did not happen gradually. The ice would melt at a regular rate, but it would form huge lakes on the ice cap itself, enormous lakes, which gradually filled up with meltwater and were sealed off from the sea by a plug of ice. When that plug of ice, when that wall of ice broke, as it inevitably and eventually would, then all the water that had been stored up for maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years before in a glacial lake, all of it would flush out into the ocean like a toilet flushing in one huge event. Uh-huh. And the flooding from Glacial Lake Missoula, which happened more than once,
is
exactly an example of that. You're looking at massive waves of water. Some of the calculations show show waves 1,000 feet high, tearing down the ice caps. So you're looking not only at the sea level rising and immersing coastlines, but also terrifying events on land itself as these ice caps broke down.
1,000-foot wave. Now,
yes.
That's something to think about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's something to think about, and it should remind us that these floods were coming off the land into the sea, as well as from the sea onto the land.
Aye, aye, aye. First-time caller line. You're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Graham.
Hi.
I'm Georgia. I'm calling from Birmingham. We're listening to you on WERC.
Yes, ma'am.
And I was wondering, you've touched on the Atlantis theory a few times, but it always puzzled me that Atlantis could be one civilization in one spot. And I always wondered, civilization that advanced would have expanded itself.
Well,
but
if you look
like now, that's what they're finding out.
It is exactly what's being found out. And, of course, if we take Atlantis back to the original, the oldest surviving source of the myth is in the work of Plato. And he does say that the Atlantis empire, as he called it, was widespread, that it was in the Mediterranean as well as in the Atlantic, and that the events that destroyed it took place in the Mediterranean as well as in the Atlantic, and that they took place around 11,500 years ago. There's only one thing that was happening then which fits the bill, and that is this cataclysmic rise in sea level. So I think it is a much more widespread thing than just one civilization.
Well, it always struck me that the civilization that advanced would have just stayed in one spot anyway.
No, it would not have stayed in one spot. It might have chosen to stay close to the sea.
Right.
I think just as the world today has different levels of social development in it, that was probably the case in the past as well. And these may have been people who did not want to go far inland, particularly when the climate inland was very bad.
That would certainly make sense, and they would not be, of course, as widespread as we are today.
No, definitely not.
So such an event today would leave survivors, but it would be a world you would not recognize, right?
You'd not recognize it. And, you know, we've all become such specialists in the modern world. I mean, we each do our particular thing well, but we don't know how anybody else does their thing. And it's a terrifying prospect to consider the disruption to society that would occur with such an event. And I suspect that our technology-based society is more fragile than it seems to be, simply because of this specialization of knowledge, because I depend on people who know things that I just don't know and am never going to know.
Graham,
that's true of everyone.
Graham, let me ask you this. If some science begins to recognize that we may be on the precipice of an event of this sort, or maybe close to it, do you believe that those counseling governments who are in charge of protecting us somehow or another, what would they do with this information?
Well, I've always been doubtful whether real information about an impending global cataclysm would be shared. I think that people in government would find lots of reasons to persuade themselves not to share it.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's what government does. It lies about things.
That's right. That's exactly how it survives, actually.
It's part of the definition of what a government is, unfortunately.
That's
I'm very suspicious of any early warning system actually being communicated to the public, simply because, you know, the officials and the bureaucrats concerned would worry about panic, and they would say, well, maybe it's not going to happen.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, we've got to look after ourselves. So, you know, all of that.
All right. A wild card line. You're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi. Where are you, sir?
I'm in actually Prince George, British Columbia, Canada.
All right.
My name is David, by the way.
Hi, David.
We all know that South America is, like, ripped away from Africa. Like, they put together, like, puzzle pieces.
Long time ago, yeah.
And the Mid-Atlantic Ridge rips from North Pole to South Pole, basically.
Sure.
Yeah.
I've been looking at a globe, and just a theory. If Aries Rock was a meteor, and you know when, a meteor hits, the center of it will bubble back up?
Yeah.
If Aries Rock did that, created Australia, the other side of the planet would rip open.
Yeah, that's called isostasy. You'd get the effect on the other side of the planet for sure.
So I don't know if that's a good theory or a bad theory. It just seems to fit the bill.
Well, it's good. Certainly if you're looking at, let's take an example of a known asteroid strike, which is the so-called KT event 65 million years ago, where a big asteroid...
In the Yucatan,
hit into the Yucatan. Well, that caused disruption on the antipodal, the opposite side of the Earth. when that happened.
But it certainly didn't rip a giant rip down the planet like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
No, it didn't. It didn't do that.
But the evidence is there.
Of a giant rip down the planet?
Yeah.
Yeah, not necessarily caused by a collision event, though. I mean, the planet has its own dynamism.
No. Another thing I was going to get into was in China with the giant pyramid and the pyramid at Giza and various other pyramids around the planet.
Yeah.
They seem to attract or concentrate kinetic or magnetic energies. Now, if you knew something was going to happen and you were able, or if the magnetic the pull of the planet was in flux and you could lift up a 1,000-ton block of stone and maneuver it where you wanted to,
mm-hmm.
could this not, if the planet was in flux, when the planet was in flux, could not that centralized magnetic field draw up from the planet? I don't know if you get
I'm getting into an area that's out of my depth here.
Yeah.
Okay, the Great Wall. Okay, here's one. The Great Wall of China, could that not have been built as a water break?
I think very unlikely. I've walked the Great Wall of China, and I don't think it was a water break at all.
No.
The topography is too up and down.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Thank goodness. I'm dying to ask this question.
Okay. Where are you, hon?
My name is Brandy. I'm in East Tennessee. I'm the one that called you and told you about the ear candles.
Oh, thank you, Brandy.
Was that young or what?
Well, it was a traumatizing experience. anyway, do you have a question for Graham?
I have. Mr. Hancock, did I hear you? You were talking earlier about radiocarbon dating, how you sometimes get in trouble for discounting it.
Yeah, I've often got into trouble for discounting it. Actually, it's not that I discount it. It's just that I believe that the orthodox academic case is already so well made and so publicly made, and we take it in with our mother's milk, that there was a time when I felt it wasn't my obligation to put the orthodox side of the case, more to put the unorthodox and alternative side. But I think it's important to take carbon dating into account.
Well, my question is, if from what I understand, is it can be that the results can be tainted on the sample in any number of ways.
They can. Carbon dating is very susceptible to contamination.
That is why I do not understand why it's such a rock for archaeology when it can be thrown off all the time by any old thing.
You're absolutely right. It can be and it is thrown off, and this is one of the reasons that I've been leery about carbon dating in the past. What I've observed is that when carbon dates support a mainstream theory, then those carbon dates are automatically accepted without question. When the carbon dates contradict a mainstream theory, they're treated as anomalies and ignored.
That's kind of like a lie detector.
Yeah.
I see. Because they don't have anything better? That's why they lay on it so much?
Well, they write on it because it is a good method within its limits. The limits involve contamination,
yeah.
First and foremost. And secondly, the fact that the test can only be run on organic materials, and you have to make the assumption that the organic material is as old as the structure you're looking at, and that assumption sometimes is incorrect.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with not a lot of time left with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hello, this is Jim in Camby, Oregon.
Yes, sir.
Back to Antarctica. Now, Antarctica itself is a landmass, correct?
It's a couple of land masses, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, what is the percentage of land mass versus the percentage of ice mass?
I actually don't know. I'm honestly not sure.
Okay, because I was curious if...
It's an interesting question. And, of course, the ice itself, were you to remove that ice all at once, it wouldn't show the total amount of land because the ice itself presses down on the land underneath it and forces that land down perhaps as much as half a mile into the Earth's crust. So when the ice is lifted off, the land would rebound and gradually more land would emerge.
Okay.
Very interesting. Very interesting. First time caller line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, where are you?
I'm in Temecula.
Temecula, all right.
Yeah. I had a question for Grant. You had a caller, or Art had a caller, I believe it was last week. He was talking about Hollow Earth.
Uh-huh.
And he said that there was a place up there, Crocker Island, up in the Arctic.
Yeah.
And he says that they were saying sometime, or the Eskimos were saying, that the Vikings sometime during an ice age had moved north up to that area. Now, if they had done so, and you're talking about advanced civilizations, how advanced would they be today if they were still there?
Huh. Well, I have to say, I believe in lots of things, or I'm open-minded to lots of things, but the Hollow Earth theory isn't one of them. I just don't buy that at all. I think it contradicts all the good evidence we have, and I think it's irrational to pursue it. Not that I object to people pursuing it if they want to. It's just not for me.
Well, of course, we know something about the Earth's innards, but not a very great deal.
No, it's true. It's a great terra incognita, literally, and a fascinating subject. But sometimes I find that it's possible to move the argument on too far, so you find yourself so far out on a limb that you're not arguing about anything sensible, and that's why I personally stay away from Hollow Earth.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, yeah, what you're doing is tough enough and going to meet a stiff enough resistance without...
Yeah, and I don't want to create another stick for my own back.
So, your book is out in Great Britain right now.
Can I just say again my website?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
You've got a link to on yours, which is www.grahamhancock.com. We have a news desk on that website, which has got links to a lot of the world press on the Indian underwater cities. People just need to comb back through that. And then the message board has had a lot of discussion on this subject, and anybody would be welcome to come and join in and join us discussing these subjects.
All right. Where does your investigation go from here?
Well, in less than a month's time, I go back to Southeast India to the site that I mentioned there, which has this enormous U-shaped structure and 27 other structures. We've got a specialist team going there with high-tech equipment, and we're going to explore and map all of these structures and try to get samples from them which can be dated. And that's being done in conjunction with India's National Institute of Oceanography.
Well, Graham, I hope once you've done that, we can have you back on and get the latest right away.
I'd love it if we could do that.
All
definitely.
Right, good. And I hope your website can take all the hits.
Thanks, Art.
Graham, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Real nice to talk to you again.
Good night, my friend.
Keep well. Bye-bye.
That's Graham Hancock. Boy, it's been a long, long time. Great guy. Kind of a modern Indiana Jones underwater. Ta-ta.